ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Welcome to ID, the Future. I'm your host, Andrew McDermott. Dr. Jonathan McClatchy is back with me today to discuss the engineering elegance and irreducible complexity of the process of bacterial cell division. Dr. McClatchy is a fellow and resident biologist at the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. He was previously an assistant professor at Sadler College in Boston, where he lectured biology for 4 years. McClatchy holds a bachelor's degree in forensic biology, a master's degree in evolutionary biology, a second master's degree in medical and molecular bioscience, and a PhD in evolutionary biology. His research interests have included the scientific evidence of design and nature, arguments for the existence of God, and New Testament scholarship. He's also founder and director of TalkAboutDoubts.com. Jonathan, welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks so much for having me back.
Now, you're a resident biologist and a fellow at Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. And as such, one of your duties is reporting regularly at evolutionnews.org on the evidence for intelligent design. And truly, it's been a pleasure to host you regularly here on the podcast so that we can unpack some of your articles. It's been a lot of fun. We've done episodes on the design and irreducible complexity of the bacterial flagellum. We did a three-part series on sexual reproduction and how much of a headache it is to explain through evolutionary processes. We've also discussed the intelligent design of muscles and our system of hearing. And today, you're here with me to discuss another design system in biology that exhibits evidence of irreducible complexity, the process of bacterial cell division. Now first, I like to start by defining irreducible complexity for those listeners who may not be as familiar with the term. It was coined by biochemist Michael Behe in his 1996 book Darwin's Black Box. The idea stems from a criterion of failure that Charles Darwin himself offered up regarding his theory of evolution. These are Darwin's words. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous, successive, slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Well, Behe defined the term irreducibly complex as referring to a single system composed of several well-matched interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, wherein the removal of any of those parts causes the system to effectively cease functioning. And since natural selection can only choose systems that are already working, if a biological system cannot be produced gradually, it would have to arise as an integrated unit in one fell swoop for natural selection to have anything to act on. Behe also noted that as the complexity of an interacting system increases, the likelihood of natural selection producing it through an indirect circuitous route drops precipitously. And of course, the more systems we can identify as irreducibly complex, the more we can say that Darwin's own criterion of failure has been met. Richard Dawkins has said that if evolution is not gradual, it ceases to have any explanatory power at all. Jonathan, what would you add to that to help us better understand irreducible complexity?
Yeah, so irreducible complexity is basically the argument that if there are certain systems in the cell that require multiple different interacting components that have to be well matched one to the other in order to perform the basic task of that system. And if you are missing any part of the system, then the system ceases to work. And so this is a challenge for a blind, undirected process to account for irreducibly complex systems, because how do you select for each step along that pathway without knowing where the target is and without having a selective benefit to select for at every step along that way? You have to pass through maladaptive intermediates to arrive at that complex endpoint. And the irreducible complexity, I think, is not merely a challenge to evolutionary naturalism, but it's also a positive argument for intelligent design as well, because intelligent agents uniquely have the ability to visualize a distant complex endpoint and then bring everything together needed to realize or to actualize that endpoint or that that goal, that objective. Whereas unguided natural processes aren't able to do that. They don't have the capacity to look to visualize complexity or distant complex endpoints or higher level objectives. And so in light of the top heavy likelihood ratio, where supposing design is involved, it's not particularly surprising that we'd find iridiscipline complex systems. Whereas supposing that no design is involved, it's wildly surprising that we'd find iridiscipline complex systems. It tends to confirm quite heavily the design thesis.
Yeah, beautifully put. And I like your reminder that it's not just a negative argument showing the limits of a Darwinian process, it's also a positive argument showing an intelligent design process in action. Well, in order for a bacterial cell to divide, it must initiate a process of cell wall breakage and resynthesis to allow for the division. Now, they say breaking up is hard to do. Well, that's even true for, you know, little minute bacteria. Because if something goes wrong, it can result in cell death, as you note in your article. Let's start with the severing or breakage of the cell wall. Tell us how bacterial cells go through controlled breakage to facilitate that cell division.
Sure. So the peptidoglycan cell wall is a rigid structure that surrounds and protects the bacterial cell, and it confers upon the cell shape and structural integrity. And as the bacterial cell prepares to divide, the cell wall has to grow as the cell elongates in preparation for division. And in rod-shaped bacteria like Salmonella or Escherichia coli, this takes place at different locations, different points along the cell. Whereas in coccus-shaped bacteria, like Staphylococcus, for example, the cell wall grows outward from the FITZ ring in opposite directions. The FITZ ring is what polymerizes around the division septum during cell division. And cell wall growth requires the controlled cleavage of the existing peptidoglycan layer, right? So the cell has to grow, and that has to be accomplished by the controlled breakage of the cell wall to facilitate that elongation. And the beta-1,4 glycosidic bonds that link the N-acetylglucosamine and the N-acetylmuramic acid get hydrolyzed by enzymes that are known as autolysins. And these have to, of course, be very carefully controlled and regulated, because otherwise it can result in programmed cell death or apoptosis, which obviously you want to avoid. And so there are specific regulatory mechanisms that guide the localization of autolysins to the site of cell division. And these regulatory mechanisms ensure that the autolysins are only targeted to the appropriate region of the cell. And so these autolysins basically bind to the peptidoglycan at the site of division, and they catalyze the hydrolysis of the peptide crosslinks within the cell wall. And this cleavage weakens the peptidoglycan at the division site, and this allows the cell wall to undergo controlled breakage, and the gaps then get filled in with additional cell wall material.
Okay. Now, following that breakage process, bacterial cells have to resynthesize the cell wall to allow for the cell division process to complete. Tell us about that part of it.
Sure. So the first stage, when we're remaking the cell wall, is the formation of the peptidoglycan precursors. So you have a chain of five amino acids. A pentapeptide is added to N-acetylmuramic acid, and N-acetylglucosamine is subsequently attached to the end of the N-acetylmuramic acid, and the result is a peptidoglycan precursor. There's a molecule called bactoprenyl, which is extremely hydrophobic, and it's embedded in the inner cytoplasmic membrane, and its role is to shuttle the hydrophilic peptidoglycan precursors from the inner side of the membrane, where they're synthesized, to the outer side of the membrane, where they're needed for the assembly of the cell wall. And this protein, bactoprenyl, is essential. It's absolutely critical because the hydrophilic precursors cannot easily traverse the hydrophobic membrane on their own. And so once this protein, bactoprenyl, arrives at the periplasmic space in gram-negative bacteria, it's the region between membranes, or the cell exterior in gram-positive bacteria, It transfers the peptoglycan precursors to the peptoglycan assembly site, and there glycosyl transferases and penicillin binding proteins, which are also known as transpeptidases, utilize these precursors to build the glycan chains and cross-link them to provide the cell wall with stability and strength. And the penicillin binding proteins are responsible for catalyzing the cross-linking of the peptide chain, peptide side chains between the diaminopamelic acid and D-alanine on adjacent peptides. So in gram-positive bacteria, cross-links typically occur from an L-lysine to a D-alanine of adjacent peptides. And at the end of the peptoglycan precursor, there exist initially two D-alanine residues, but one gets removed during the reaction, leaving one in the final molecule. In E. coli, a specialized penicillin binding protein known as FITZI is the key player in transpeptidation at the septum, and localization of this protein FITZI to the septum itself requires an intact N-terminal membrane anchor, in addition to the division proteins FITZ, FITZA, FITZQ, FITZW, and FITZL.
Okay, so a very complicated process that is happening, and you can't really have the breakage without the resynthesis, can you? I mean, you have to have both at the same time.
That's exactly right. And this is why this is such a significant challenge to an evolutionary account of how such a complex system could have come to be. Because absolutely critical to cell division in virtually all bacteria is the ability to resynthesize peptoglycan. And the mechanism of action of the beta-lactam antibiotics, which include penicillin, cephalosporins, and monobactams, is to interfere with the peptoglycan cross-linking. And as their name implies, penicillin binding proteins are the target of penicillin drugs, which results in them losing their enzymatic activity. And the activity of the autolysins weakens the cell wall to such an extent that the cell lyses or bursts open. And because they're not able to rebuild that cell wall in a coordinated fashion because the penicillin binding proteins which perform the cross-linking have been interfered with. Some other non-beta-lactam antibiotics, such as lactobacillus, have a similar mechanism of action. And antibiotics may also target cell wall precursors. So, for example, the antibiotic Nisin associates with the cell wall precursor lipid 2 and locks it in a stable complex and thereby effectively inhibits the peptoglycan synthesis cycle. But all this is to show that how crucial it is that we can that the bacterial cell can resynthesize the cell wall in a coordinated way after its severing by these very tightly regulated autolysin enzymes. So, I mean, consider the following two observations. So firstly, you know, critical to the elongation process is the severing of the peptoglycan cell wall by the autolysins. And critical, secondly, to cell viability is the resynthesis of the peptoglycan cell wall. So these processes have to be very highly coordinated. So if you have the mechanism for severing the cell wall coming to be without simultaneously having a mechanism in hand to rebuild the cell wall, then the cell would not survive the division process. So both mechanisms have to arise together. And this is, in fact, an example of what I would call irreducible complexity on steroids, because cell division is absolutely crucial for differential survival, which of course is a requisite for natural selection. And so you can't really get off the ground without assuming the existence of the very thing you're trying to explain, namely a self-replicating cell.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, some have claimed that the breakage process may have been co-opted into the cell division process over time. What's wrong with that idea?
Yeah, so on this objection, you might have a situation where the mechanism for repairing the breaks in the cell wall arose first, and then that became co-opted into the cell division machinery. But this really doesn't work, because without being able to sever the cell wall, there could be no division. And so, as I said before, there would be no differential survival, and by extension, there would be no natural selection. So you don't even get evolution off the ground until you have a self-replicating molecule or a self-replicating cell.
Yeah, yeah. So co-option, not an option here. Well, virtually all bacteria conduct these processes as part of cell division. But there's one notable exception that you note in your article, and that's mycoplasma. Tell us about that and whether it's relevant to the argument that these processes exhibit irreducible complexity.
Yeah, so the process of severing and rebuilding the cell wall is critical to cell division in almost all bacteria. There are a small handful of exceptions. So mycoplasma doesn't have a cell wall, but this has little relevance to accounting for the origins of the mechanism of severing and rebuilding the peptoglycan in those species that do possess a cell wall. And as soon as the cell wall, which is a rigid outer layer that provides structural support to the cell, rose, there would need to be a mechanism for remodeling and splitting it to allow the bacterial cell to divide into two daughter cells. And moreover, mycoplasma species are obligate parasites, so they dwell in osmotically protected habitats. And furthermore, in place of a cell wall, they typically have sterols in their cytoplasmic membrane, which imparts to them greater rigidity and strength.
Okay. Now, you write that these processes, the severing and the resynthesis of cell wall during bacterial cell division, require foresight. And I want to dwell on that word foresight for a few minutes before we close here today. Give us your definition of foresight and tell us, are evolutionary processes capable of foresight?
Yeah, so foresight is the ability to visualize a distant complex endpoint. And natural processes, evolutionary type mechanisms, don't have the ability to look into the future and retain particular components or functions or systems in view of some future utility. It's going to work now, and if it doesn't work now, it's not going to be retained by natural selection. Whereas intelligent agents have the capability, the unique capability, of visualizing distant complex endpoints and bringing together all that is needed to actualize or to arrive at that complex higher level objective. So that is what we mean by foresight. And foresight is indistinguishable from intelligence. And so as soon as you have a process such as irreducibly complex systems in biology or embryogenesis where you require foresight to visualize going from a zygote, a fertilized egg, to the final form of the organism. Obviously, you have a process of division and differentiation, specification, and that requires that you have a goal in mind that you're headed towards. Obviously, if you only get halfway across embryogenesis, then you're not going to have a viable organism. So that's another example of something that requires foresight. Another example would be apoptosis, which is a mechanism during embryo development where our digits form by programmed cell death between our digits, and that's how our fingers and toes emerge during embryogenesis. And of course, that has to be very carefully controlled and regulated and requires a process of foresight. How would natural selection select for a process involving cell death without knowing what the purpose is or knowing what the target is? So foresight, I think, is when we see complex systems that require foresight to bring about, I think that's a very powerful evidence of design and a very strong challenge to naturalistic evolutionary accounts.
Yeah, indeed. Well, and at this point, I want to remind listeners that one of our colleagues has written a whole book on how the chemistry of life reveals planning and purpose. It's called Foresight, by Brazilian chemist and professor Dr. Marcos Eberlin. In a chapter on bacteria, bugs, and carnivorous plants, Dr. Eberlin reminds us that bacteria are often seen as rudimentary forms of life, but one look at their molecular structure is enough to convince us otherwise. Bacteria are extremely sophisticated, fully equipped with many exquisite molecular machines. So, if you're ever tempted to think, why are we talking about bacteria? I mean, who cares about tiny bacteria? What's that got to do with me? Well, the idea is that even if the simplest forms of life exhibit stunning complexity and engineering prowess, all the more so do we. And that complexity and design demands an adequate explanation. We can tell an evolutionary just-so story, or we can acknowledge the limits of Darwinian processes and study living things as products of engineering and foresight. And in his book, Eberlin encourages us to dip a toe in the ocean of ingenuity. Ingenuity that in our universal experience is wedded to a powerful, unique... Sorry, let me re-say that last sentence there. In his book, Eberlin encourages us to dip a toe in the ocean of ingenuity. Ingenuity that in our universal experience is wedded to a power unique to intelligent agents, and that is foresight. Jonathan, closing words on this topic today?
Yeah, this is just one example of many hundreds or thousands of systems that we could discuss which exhibit irreducible complexity and are and point to the necessity of foresight to explain their origin, which of course is going to be indistinguishable from a mind, an intelligent agency. And so, I totally second your recommendation for Marcus Eberlin's book on foresight. I'd also, of course, recommend all of Behe's books. Darwin's Black Box is a great introduction to the subject of irreducible complexity. And there are many other great resources. Secrets of the Cell, the video series with Michael Behe, is also an excellent good place to start.
Yeah. And I'm looking forward to unpacking more of the irreducible complexity of various biological systems with you in the future. Thanks for stopping by today, Jonathan.
Oh, thank you.
Well, we'll include links to Jonathan's article on bacterial cell division, as well as Dr. Eberlin's book, Foresight, in the show notes for this episode. And I'll even throw in the Secrets in the Cell series that Jonathan just mentioned, great video series unpacking Dr. Behe's central arguments. So all that's accessible at idthefuture.com. And of course, you can find more of Dr. McClatchy's writing and his videos at jonathanmcclatchy.com. And that's spelled Jonathan McClatchy, McClatchie.com. Well, for ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.